Spectrum's brought to you by the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University. Before a new idea can become a way of thinking, before one detail can flip the narrative, before anything that matters can change the world, it must, above all, be known. The duty of the Scripps College of Communication is to bring forth the people who bring forth the knowledge, by word or image or data stream and in every medium, and by all means, they succeed. They say, make it loud, make it clear, make it known. Learn more at ohio.edu/Scripps College. Welcome to Spectrum. I'm your host, Tom Hodson. On Spectrum, we cover a wide range of topics. We feature journalists, authors, scholars, policymakers, activists, innovators, and sometimes people with just fascinating stories. Today, we're having a special conversation with Judge Gail Williams Byers about some of the recent court decisions concerning former President Donald Trump. Judge Gail and I, as two retired judges, will try to break down the rulings into ordinary language and make them understandable to the average listener. Judge, there's so much going on in courts around the country, especially courts dealing with former President Donald Trump, and that's what we're going to concentrate on today. But before we get into some of the details, let me ask you a question. Do you think the general public understands what's going on in all of these cases? Do you think the media has done a good job of trying to break things down for people?
So, Judge, I think this is one of those complex situations where even the most learned amongst us, those who speak legalese as a native language, are finding it difficult to keep up because it's so much happening and it's so fast moving, it's so fast paced that even those of us who kind of live in this world are sometimes finding it difficult to just keep with the pace. And if that's our experience, I think to your primary question of, well, how must the rest of the general public be digesting this and understanding it? I think their heads are spinning. And I think that they have very little, they already have perhaps a limited knowledge base. So they already don't speak legalese as a native or second language. And then to have so much of it happening so frequently and there being constant decisions coming out so regularly that it's hard to keep up. It can probably feel exhausting. I would suspect that that also probably lends to, you know, the diminution or the lessening of faith in the justice system, because quite frankly, let's face it, anything you don't know and you don't understand, you probably don't trust.
Well, that's true. And in addition, I think that people are so overloaded with this. And I don't think, my personal opinion is, the media hasn't done a good job of translating things into words or situations that people can understand. And so people are just turned off by it. And they just say, the heck with it, I'm not going to deal with it.
Isn't that ostrich effect how we often deal with things, whether it's this or just about anything else? But I think given the circumstances, you have just defined exactly why it's all the more likely that people are treating the situation and the several cases like that. First of all, because, you know, when in our lifetimes have we ever seen a single defendant, if you will, who also holds such a high public stature, have so many cases, whether it's criminal or civil, kind of going on all at the same time? That in and of itself is kind of thunderstriking. And then to try to understand, you know, most people don't really appreciate the differences between criminal cases and civil cases and why someone can, you know, maybe choose or elect to appear at this hearing but and not show up at another hearing, and when do the rules apply, and, you know, when are those rules effective, and Is there some special status for this person versus anyone else? I think all of those things kind of come into play, because remember, at the end of the day, most people are reflecting on themselves and they're wondering, you know, if this were me, how would I be treated and would I be able to keep up with all of this? And yeah, I'd probably need a lawyer to kind of dissect and interpret this for me on a regular basis. So I hope we can do this service to others who might be listening in on our conversation and make it a little easier for them to understand at the end of the day.
Well, in addition, we've got two court systems in the country, really 51 court systems. You have 50 states, with each one having its own court system. Most of them are pretty much alike, except Louisiana, which is based on French law instead of British law. But you then have state courts, and then you have federal courts. And it's really difficult, I think, for people to separate the two.
You are absolutely correct. I think trying to understand the different system just generally is its own challenge. Trying to understand the different systems as it relates to the different states that have the different rules is even more of a challenge. And it's a big challenge, again, even for those who kind of inhabit this world of courts, legalese, systems of jurisprudence, versus those who are just like, listen, you know, whenever I have to go to court, I just want to find the door as fast as I can, because I just don't want to stay there any longer than I have to. If those are the folks that are listening and watching this unfold, this is really a head scratcher for them.
Well, you and I, both retired judges, both sort of legal analysts in various ways. We're going to try to do this over a period of time here and try to break things down for people. So we hope that they tune in. We hope that they listen to what we have to say. If they don't understand something, I give an email address at the end. They can send us an email to ask us to explain something further, but we're going to make an effort to break this down for people so that it's in understandable bites. We're not going to cover it like most media right now are covering these legal situations like sporting events, who wins, who loses, who's ahead. You know, we're not going to do that. We're going to look at procedures, but break them down in sort of a really bite-sized way so that people can understand it. And we're going to try to do this in a timely way. And the most recent things going on have been in state court in Georgia. Now, the prosecutor in Fulton County, which is Atlanta, Fannie Willis has brought a multi-count indictment against multiple defendants, including the former president, and has brought it under state law for alleged crimes that have occurred in the state of Georgia. Now, in the state of Georgia, they have an elected system for prosecutors, and they have an elected system for judges. In the cases, all of these cases are being heard by one judge, a young man by the name of Scott McAfee, a relatively new judge to the bench, but not new to the courtroom. He was a former assistant prosecutor. In fact, worked, I think, for Fannie Willis at one point. But because there are so many defendants in this case, you're going to get motion after motion after motion filed before the trial. And the purpose from the defense perspective, and I'm a former defense attorney as well as a retired judge, the purpose is not only to delay the case, if that's your intent, but also to try to chip away at what the prosecution has, chip away at their cases. Just this past week, Judge McAfee dismissed six counts of this multi-count indictment. Now, what he said, these were on the solicitation of violation with a public official or a public officer. Breaking that down, this was the telephone call between President Trump, at that time President Trump, and Georgia election officials, and follow-up calls by other defendants to those election officials. Judge McAfee dismissed those six counts. Now, what we need to get across, I think, Judge Gale, is that he didn't throw those out. It wasn't a huge win for Donald Trump. It wasn't a huge loss for the state. Can you sort of explain what went on there?
Certainly. And I want to say thanks for the introduction, because you outlined perfectly exactly what happened and what the judge was looking to do in dismissing these charges. As you said, these were the six charges that were very specifically related to the telephone call between, as you indicated, former President Trump and I believe even Mark Meadows, as well as Brad Raffensperger,
Rudy Giuliani,
and Brad Raffensperger and his office. And Brad Raffensperger is still the Secretary of State in Georgia. And what the judge said is that when the prosecution brings charges, they are required to bring charges that contain what are called the essential elements of the crime. And when you do that and you allege what the essential elements, meaning the specific elements that will ultimately have to be proven at trial, you also have to allege enough detail in bringing those charges that you explain essentially the nature of the commission of the offense. And so what the judge here said was, I'm looking at these charges. I see that the state has brought them, and even that they've presented them to a grand jury, which is the grand jury is responsible for returning charges. And you should understand that when a grand jury is considering charges, they're considering them and answering two very basic questions, what we call the standard of proof, or the ability for them to answer those questions and then return an indictment successfully, means that the grand jury has to answer, first of all, the question of, was a crime committed? And is this person likely the person that committed the crime? Now, that sounds like a really, really basic threshold, and that's because it is. At the grand jury stage, it's not the same as if you're presenting to a jury that actually determines facts. That's called a Pettit jury. The grand jury, again, is just really responsible for answering these two questions, and often that's where we get all the jokes that says, you know, prosecutors can indict a ham sandwich, because they're really, the grand jurors are really answering these two questions. But even—
Is there a crime? And did, more probably than not, this defendant commit that crime?
Is this person likely the person who committed the crime? That is it. And not much more, and not more than that, is required at the grand jury stage. However, in this instance, the judge, Judge McAfee, said it may be correct that the grand jurors answered those questions, but the indictment itself doesn't really provide enough detail regarding the nature of the crime itself for this charge or these six charges to still remain intact. And because he found that the underlying evidence, or the solicitation, if you will, that was underpinning these charges was insufficient, and that they did not give the defendants enough information so that they can intelligently prepare their defense, is what he said, that these charges required that he dismiss them with what's called prejudice, not without what's called prejudice meaning. And so when a charge is dismissed without prejudice, what it does is it leaves the prosecution with the right or the ability to present again, in this instance, to the grand jury, these same charges, essentially tightening up their case at the grand jury stage. And it doesn't mean that they will win or they'll survive these charges when presented to a jury that will determine guilt or acquittal. But what the judge is saying is that the basic threshold or the basic responsibility to provide the defense with enough information to intelligently defend these charges is lacking. And because of that, he dismissed the charges, but left the prosecution with the right or the ability to go back to the grand jury, present again, and to see if the grand jury would return those same charges, if at all. Because remember, this new grand jury could choose not to return those charges. They could find that either no crime was committed, or even if it was committed, that these were not the people who allegedly committed the crime. Because what you have to keep in mind is the grand jurors have to answer yes to both of those questions in order to return an indictment.
So let me break this down even further and see if I'm correct in this. You can be my fact checker. The judge said, you know, you have to talk about the elements of the offense. You have to put out enough facts in the indictment to show that this particular act led to this particular offense. However, in this case, it's not that you didn't do any of that. You put in so many facts and so many allegations that the defense could never defend against this because, you know, you might have 50 different factual allegations and you're really only trying to prove one. The defense doesn't know which one you're trying to prove. What you got to do is take those 50, and this is my hypothetical, you've got to take those 50 allegations and boil it down to the core elements of the offense. Now, an element of an offense is like an assault. You knowingly caused physical harm to another. You know, that's the elements of an assault. So you got to take all of these facts in this solicitation of a public officer and get it down to the bare bones of what you are charging this person did inappropriately that causes it to be a crime. Have I got it right?
And you do, absolutely. And perhaps part of the challenge in this case, given how unique it is because there were so many defendants, and so many defendants were involved in different types or different levels or different charges, that the prosecution, in their effort to really spell out the case in detail, as you kind of put it here, they may have included more detail than necessary for any particular defendant, because remember, every case is to that own defendant. And so even if you and I are charged with a same or similar crime and we're co-defendants, meaning we're charged together, I have an individual right to understand specifically what the prosecution is alleging that I did. And I have a right to understand that without the confusion, the potential confusion of what they're saying you did, so that you can defend your charges separately and I can defend my charges separately. And so perhaps, yes, one of the better steps would be is to go back and to narrow down for each defendant what their actions were, so that they can now go to court and say, okay, this is what you said I did, and this is how I am going to prepare my defense against these charges without the interference of and perhaps the distraction of worrying about what my co-defendants have been charged with doing.
So in essence, nobody won on this one. It was, let's clarify things or give the prosecution an opportunity to clarify things so the defense can prepare a defense to a particular charge. The prosecution has a time period to do that, and if they choose not to do that, then the case goes forward with the remaining charges, which really are the core of the case, and that's the RICO charges, correct?
You're absolutely right. That would mean that if the prosecution decided, you know, this is not an achievable goal, or we believe we would confuse the grand jurors all the more, or we just don't think that it's, you know, worth the effort to return to the grand jury because, as you said, the heart of the case is still intact, then yeah, they can just go forward with the racketeering charges, which is what RICO stands for, racketeering, influenced, and corrupt organizations charges, which is something we usually saw, you know, reserved for the Al Capones of the world.
And organized crime, big time.
It was the organized crime statute, which we're seeing used in more unique ways. And that's, I think, in part because society is evolving, things become a little more innovative, and statutes, the way that they were written, can certainly be interpreted in ways that suit the signs of the times, if you will.
All right. So I think we've hit it on those six counts that were dismissed by Judge McAfee. But the big part of that Georgia case was 2.5 days worth of testimony, a public hearing that was televised about whether prosecutor Fannie Willis and her special prosecutor, Nathan Wade, should be dismissed from the case because of various unethical allegations. The unethical allegations boiled down to that they had an affair, a romantic and sexual relationship that tainted, one, her hiring of Nathan Wade, and two, their relationship afterwards. And the second part of this was that she Fannie Willis profited from the relationship because they took trips together, that there was allegations that he paid for. She only paid for some. She paid cash and reimbursed him for some. But it was those two things, basically, that we had this hearing about. Is that framed right?
I think largely. I would say that the allegation, particularly as it relates to the financial benefits, was more so that Prosecutor Willis absolutely financially benefited from the hiring of former Judge Wade, because he's a retired judge and was practicing as an attorney, that she financially benefited from the hiring of him, and that there were no times, at least according to the allegations, when she reimbursed for any of this. So all of the financial benefit she derived from that relationship, as opposed to just some. And that's what, you know, soured the prosecutor's office from its ability to continue prosecuting this case.
Now, the background of this is, if Fannie Willis had been removed from the case, the prosecutor, that would have left it up to state officials who would perhaps have been less inclined to go forward with the case.
Oh, Judge, you're suggesting that Fulton County is the only place that would perhaps proceed with this prosecution.
Well, what do you think?
here's what I think. I think there's a reason why the Georgia legislature recently passed statutes that would seek to penalize, to review, and even remove locally elected and appointed prosecutors. And I think that in light of that, that perhaps more than Fulton County could have possibly brought a case like this, and still fairly so. I'm kind of shocked at the state legislature's what I think is a bit of overreach in looking to control how cases are prosecuted. Because as you indicated in the introduction, Prosecutor Willis is an elected official, as are the state representatives, the state senators, and the members of the state legislature. And so, you know, the kind of overreach in reaching over into that office and kind of dictating to them how to do their jobs when perhaps many in a state legislature are not lawyers and they have no ability how to package, how to investigate, how to bring forward and how to prosecute a case is really stunning to me. So maybe it would not have been just Fulton County, but I will tell you that the suggestion here, it sounds like, is that maybe Fulton County is the only place that perhaps has the resources and even the interest in bringing forward such a case. And there seemed to be a whole lot of uneasiness in the state of Georgia about that. So I will give you credit to that point, but I do think there might be other places in Georgia that would have been just as willing.
Well, the end result is we don't have to worry
You're
about
right.
it because Judge McAfee, after this 2.5 days, of testimony, issued Friday, this past Friday morning, a 23-page opinion, and we'll go through parts of that and explain it to you and try to translate that 23 pages down into to bite-sized chunks. But the key was that he said Fonnie Willis could stay on the case, but Nathan Wade, the special prosecutor, had to go. If Fonnie Willis chose not to have Nathan Wade go, then she would have to go. It was an either-or situation. And, that's sort of like the old Solomon proverb of slicing the baby in half, kind of thing. But the judge's opinion made a whole lot of sense, and I want to go through parts of that with you. But the idea is Fonnie Willis is an elected official. The court says there wasn't enough evidence to disqualify her. And Nathan Wade, there was an appearance of impropriety, and he would have to go. That afternoon, Friday afternoon, Nathan Wade submitted his letter of resignation, and it was accepted by Fonnie Willis. So the case is back to having no lead prosecutor at this point, but it's back on track. All of that being said, let's first talk about why was the court involved in this to begin with? People know that doctors, lawyers, they're licensed by states. Those licensing procedures come with rules of discipline. Those rules of discipline, if one violates them, there can be sanctions, everything from disbarment to suspension to fines in some cases. Why was this a court matter and not just a legal ethical matter?
You know, Judge, I think that's a fantastic question. And I'd also invite your insight as to that as well. Because my first inclination when I first heard it was, well, there are plenty remedies available for lawyers or judges or anyone holding a law license under these circumstances. That's exactly why we are all required to adhere to a code of ethics. And when there is a failure to do that, then you can always threaten someone's license by reporting them to their bar association or their disciplinary counsel, whose responsibility it is to take up these types of issues and to determine if there were any wrongdoing. And then if in fact it was, they can punish accordingly, up to and including all the things that you just named, including disbarment, which means taking a lawyer's license. That is like the nuclear option, right? That is the worst thing that any lawyer wants to see happen is to be disbarred, even if it's temporarily disbarred. That's very different from just having a suspension where, you know, there's a definite time when it's over. I wondered in part why this was before Judge McAfee, because here's what I knew from the beginning is that any smart judge especially given all of the evidence as it came out. And I believe Judge McAfee is very smart. I thought that his opinion was very thoughtful. But I felt like any judge who really gave this the time and attention it deserved would rule just as he did. And each side would be equally unhappy. That's the best kind of ruling, is when both sides are walking away, slamming doors, snatching attaches and briefcases.
You know, as judge, that's sometimes your best decisions.
Those are your best. When you can sit back and you're like, I must have done a really good job, because I'm telling you.
Both sides,
right,
are
right, they're
unhappy.
Going to lunch together to talk about you. Because you're both upset and angry with what you did. And so I knew, I said, this is actually absolutely perfect. When the judge is Solomon and does this, that's when you know you really hit the nail on the head. And that's exactly what happened here. And again, I wouldn't be surprised if both sides, the prosecutors and the defense, were all at the lunch table in the cafeteria talking about how terrible the judge was. What also bothered me at the end, I think, is when you had one side, I didn't really hear squawking as much from the prosecutors as I did the defense. But I think I heard from the defense judge that they were still upset with Judge McAfee because he had not totally and completely holistically ruled in their favor. And then they reached back to the point, something that you noted earlier, of the fact that Judge McAfee formerly worked in the office where Prosecutor Willis was his boss. And that may very well have been true, but I'm also not aware that the defense vehemently demanded, requested, or even raised the issue of recusal of Judge McAfee, if they were that concerned about what influence, if any, the prosecutor's office might have on the judge. And mind you, there are plenty of judges that are former somethings, right? Former.
That's one of those after the fact comments. When you lose, that's one of those throw out a
Let's
comment.
See if it sticks. And this is one of those things that, and the reason I say that is because I think the judge really try to extend and maybe overextend himself in the area of fairness and helping to restore the public's faith in this process by issuing such a, I think, very well-reasoned opinion here about what he found to be facts, and based on those facts, how those facts, as he determined them to be, led him to the ultimate determination, which I'll tell you, Prosecutor Wade issued a resignation probably faster than some Marvel characters would have in any given movie. I mean, that he might actually be in the market for being one of the Marvel superheroes with the swiftness with which he responded, because that was fast. But I'll actually kick that to you as to why was it here as opposed to in front of a disciplinary council?
All right. So two things. One, the judge says my ruling does not precluded from going before disciplinary counsel. So you can still file complaints, and complaints have been filed by various defendants against Fani Willis. You can file complaints with disciplinary counsel, and my ruling does not prohibit that. What he said in his opinion was, under Georgia law, and we're talking state law here, under Georgia law and the case law in Georgia, he has a duty as the trial judge to make sure that the trial goes forward with fundamental fairness and that there are no conflicts of interest that are apparent that may turn the verdict one way or the other, may taint the trial process. He had the duty to look at this. That's why he had the 2.5-day hearing. A lot of people say, why did he do this? Was that for show? No. In his mind and his interpretation of Georgia law, he had to have that hearing. He had to make a determination whether there was a conflict of interest that was sufficient to taint the process. And he found, as it related to Fani Willis, that the defendants, who had the burden of proof. In other words, they had to prove that there was enough of a conflict of interest that it would taint the outcome of the case, had that potential to taint the outcome of the case. And he found that they did not meet their burden of proof. However, in this situation, there is factual impropriety, and there is what's called the appearance of impropriety. Attorneys, judges are to avoid both the actual impropriety and the appearance of impropriety. So Judge McAfee decided that in the case that the evidence showed that there was not sufficient evidence to show factual impropriety. And he went through all the witnesses of how they were, some of them were credible, some of them were not, in his mind. And he was the decider of who was credible and who wasn't. But he landed on this appearance of impropriety. Can you talk about that a little bit, Judge?
Oh, absolutely. And so the responsibility is that judges, lawyers, those in the legal, having a legal and ethical obligation to ensure that cases are handled properly, that they themselves avoid even what appears to be or could be perceived by others as improper. There's no requirement. The requirement doesn't just exist when it is actually or shown to be or proven to be wrong or maybe smells a little or doesn't look right. The requirement is that you avoid even what could appear to be improper, even if it is determined later that it was not. In this instance, even though Judge McAfee did not make a determination of wrongdoing, meaning he did not find that the burden was met to show that District Attorney Willis and Attorney Wade actually engaged in improper behavior, and in fact said as much that he, although he was troubled by some of the testimony, he still could not say conclusively that the relationship existed at the improper time, meaning existed before he was appointed, meaning Attorney Wade was appointed as the special prosecutor. He could not make that determination, and he also could not make the determination and could not make the finding of fact that Attorney Willis, District Attorney Willis, had actually profited or benefited from the compensation that Attorney Wade had been paid, because there was at least competing testimony, evidence, and information that there was reimbursement, proper reimbursement for any expenditures. But that wasn't the point. Even beyond that point, and beyond the fact that the judge could not determine that those were facts, what he said is that, assuming you were part of the general public and you're viewing all of this, and you don't know if the relationship persists or does not persist, what you do know is that based on the allegations or based on everything that's been presented, it's bad enough that any reasonable person in this general community could reasonably believe that A, this is or could have been the situation, and that if that's the case, it is improper. It at least looks improper. And the requirement is that you stay away from or avoid even what appears to be improper. And the way to do that, and there are only a few ways to cure that, and by cure that, it means to fix it. The only way to fix that under these circumstances is one of two ways, is either to have Attorney Wade resign his position as the special prosecutor, or if the insistence is that he remains and that he continues as the special prosecutor, then Prosecutor Willis, and this was a fine line, I think, that Judge McAfee made. Prosecutor Willis must then recuse or remove herself. Now, the order did not say that her office must remove itself, but it did speak to her specifically because of her engagement with Prosecutor Wade. So he was really clear to say it's either one person or the other, as opposed to the whole office or the other person, which is what the defense wanted. The defense wanted the not only Prosecutor Willis, but the entire office of the prosecutor to be removed, the Fulton County prosecutor to be removed from prosecuting this case, and also to go as far as to dismiss all the charges. Now, again, that's not something
that and he said, I'm doing this because of the appearance of impropriety.
Because it appears.
They didn't approve. Yes. They didn't prove impropriety. I'm doing this because of the appearance.
Exactly.
Of impropriety.
And again, with the impropriety or the improper nature of the allegations, it appears that way, even though he absolutely concedes and was very clear to say in his opinion, I'm not finding that it was actually improper. But remember, that's not the rule or the standard. The standard is to avoid the appearance. And when the standard is met, meaning when you get to at least the appearance part, then yeah, you got to do something about it. And this is the something that he ordered be done about it.
All right. So let's get to just a little bit before I move on. And that is strategy, defense strategy, obviously, as we talked earlier, is delay and also to chip away at the prosecution's case. This was one major distraction. It took weeks and 2.5 days of testimony for this matter to be resolved. So did they accomplish delay? Yes.
Absolutely.
did they get rid of Funny Willis? No, but they damaged the case by getting rid of the lead prosecutor. So now somebody new has to come in, learn the case, which may cause additional delay. From a defense point of view, another win.
Well, if I can just pause there.
Let me finish. Let me finish. And I'll get back to you. I'm on a roll here. The next thing is Fani Willis is up for election. And all of this publicity, they're hoping, I don't know that that will be a fact in Fulton County, but they're hoping this November get her removed from office so a new prosecutor can come in and dismiss the case. And the last point is they just think that this may have tainted a jury pool so that they won't believe anything Fani Willis or her office says. I'm done. Your turn.
Well, next will be a motion for a new venue. Because there will be the argument. And by a new venue, it means, hey, can you move this case to a totally different city or another community?
Hey, I'd leave it there, hoping that she's been tainted enough.
Precisely. However, I think the problem with that tainting is it goes, I think, to a different level and a different permutation. I do believe that this wasn't all legal, but part of it was absolutely intended to be political. And that political gamesmanship is a very messy business. And that, remember, both District Attorney Fani Willis, Judge Scott McAfee, and the primary defendant in this case, the former president, are all on the ballot this year, all three of them. So this is very unique in that regard. I know that Judge McAfee has drawn opponents in his race, obviously.
So is Fani Willis.
And so has Fani Willis. However, I don't know that there's a real appetite in Fulton County, which is the geographic area where her pool of voters is. I don't know if that necessarily will be enough to remove her from office. And here's why I say this. In a community that has perhaps been yearning for strong leadership, and has had that demonstrated, I think to some degree, just as, you know, society has to some degree really forgiven the former president for any indiscretions that he may have committed, both in his personal life and previously, they're willing to give him potentially another shot. I would think, and I'd like to believe that Fani Willis, in the way that she has handled this prosecution, at least up until this point, would be given at least the opportunity to continue her work. Because remember, notwithstanding this relationship with Attorney Wade, that is distinct from the actual work that she has done in leading the prosecution of this case. And perhaps her strongest argument is that her personal life had no impact on how she has committed her life to public service and has done the work on behalf of the people of Fulton County.
And as a defense attorney, I would argue just the opposite.
Oh, absolutely. I would expect as much.
that her lack of judgment shows her lack of judgment. If she has that much lack of judgment in her personal life, what is this case all about? Look at the lack of judgment she's had in the facts of this case. I mean, that would be my argument. I don't think it would go anywhere.
and mind you, that lack of judgment is limited to that singular relationship. Remember, Attorney Wade isn't the only special prosecutor that was appointed. He's one of at least three. I would even go as far as to say, and you've probably seen this in your dealings, either, you know, in your private practice or even in your dealings as a judge, I think any good prosecutor's office always has backups just ready to come in. And so insofar as yes, there may be the need to appoint another special prosecutor for this case, it's highly unlikely, at least in my view, that the next special prosecutor that's appointed will be the lead. They'll likely select a lead from who's already there because they know the case already.
Let me make one point, because people wonder if President Trump, former President Trump, gets elected, you know, he could pardon himself. He could appoint the Justice Department to get rid of the cases against him. That only applies to federal charges and federal court. That does not apply to Georgia state law, which we're talking about here. So even if this case goes beyond the November election, it is protected against his direct interference.
You are correct in that regard, but also consider that, again, this is also that intersection of law and politics, right? So, yes, it is absolutely so that state law is separate and distinct from federal law. And if he were to be reelected, he could direct the U.S. Department of Justice to either not defend any appeals against him or to completely walk away from any of the pending charges or indictments that are pending against him, which is separate and distinct from what's happening both in Georgia and New York and any other state that would potentially elect to bring charges. However, that intersection or that odd intersection with politics comes into play in Georgia when you think about the fact that pardons can be sought from governors. And the state of Georgia does have Governor Brian Kemp, who shares the same political party affiliation as former President Trump. I don't know that I'm suggesting that the former president would approach Governor Kemp, although it may not be beneath him to do that, or if he would have surrogates to do that. But the fact of the matter is that even if he were convicted in Georgia, he may seek to, again, manipulate potentially the levers in state government in order to achieve the same kind of, potentially get out of jail free card as he would have if he were elected to the presidency again. And that's something I think we should maybe keep our eyes on. I know that I don't know that there's been any clear indication that Governor Kemp and former President Trump have befriended each other necessarily, but I don't know that were he to be convicted of these charges, that there might not be a very considerable campaign unleashed to provide him some kind of benefit.
We've got just a few minutes left, Judge, and I want to move down to Florida, one state below Georgia, and now we're in the federal case. And this is the secret documents case, the Mar-a-Lago case. It goes by various names. Judge Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee to the federal bench, is in charge of this case. She's had a spotty record in the sense that she's been slapped down by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals for some rulings that they thought were too favorable to former President Trump. But there were some motions before her just recently, last week, in fact, where arguments were made on the constitutionality of certain statutes as they applied to the defendant, President, former President Trump. The judge hasn't ruled on one of those two motions that she heard, but on the other one, she ruled against former President Trump, but left a big question mark hanging out there. Can you explain what's going on with that procedurally?
This is the part of the case that gives me heartburn. And it gives me heartburn because I'm really concerned about what happens next. And by that, I mean, there's a chart or the motion to dismiss charges against former President Donald Trump in the documents case. And the argument was that the law was unconstitutionally vague, or that the language of the statute was very, very vague. I mean, nothing that we perhaps haven't seen before from defendants who perhaps tried the same thing, right? Oh, this can't possibly apply to me because the statute is not clearly written such that it makes sense that this is actually applicable to me. Now, what's happened in some...
Especially defendants with a lot of money that can bring those
exactly
motions.
And what's happened and summarily is these motions have been denied because they've been seen for what they are, either stall tactics or just having no applicability to the defendant, or the fact that the underlying facts really clearly outline the defendant's involvement and why the statute applies to their alleged behavior. And yes, there are more facts that are required to come out in trial in order to meet for the state or the government to meet its burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed this crime and that they should be held accountable. Absolutely. But the idea that it's so vague that it could not be understood or understood to apply to the defendant is something that's often just, you know, you kind of, you know, cover your mouth and try to keep from chuckling because, you know, often there are these throwaway arguments. And this seemed like one of those throwaway arguments, the kitchen sink, if you will. Let's throw everything in there.
Yeah, and the judge said, that's the throwaway argument. We can't decide that now.
And that's the part that gives me the heartburn.
The big but.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the part that gives me the heartburn. Because had the judge made a decision on that issue of vagueness at that time, you could best believe that whichever side was unhappy with that decision, they would be marching right back to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and they would be asking them to review that opinion. Now, if history is any indicator of what we may have seen had she ruled in that moment, it probably would have been Prosecutor Jack Smith and his office heading to the 11th Circuit because they hadn't been really successful with Judge Cannon. In this instance, however, when she said, you know what? Yeah, let's hold off on deciding that. Now really isn't a good time to make that determination. So I'm not going to grant the motion.
I'll decide against you now. But I'll let you bring it up.
And actually encouraged the defense to consider revisiting the motion at a later time, i.e. perhaps trial, which is the prosecution's worst nightmare. And the reason why it's the prosecution's worst nightmare, being a former prosecutor, the first thing I thought about is this is exactly a recipe for tanking the case. Because if the court decides this particular motion only after a jury is selected, seated, and sworn in, then that is the definition of what we call double jeopardy. And when double jeopardy attaches, which is that is the time at which it attaches, and then the court then after that makes the determination that, you know what, I had a chance to think about that. And I'm glad that the defense brought it back to my attention. And now that I've had a chance to kind of ruminate over it and I've heard the arguments and I've now appreciated kind of the factual underpinnings of that argument, I think now is a good time to grant the defense's motion. That, I think, is what will cause the state's heart to sink, because at that point, with double jeopardy attaching, it also means the state has no recourse. They don't have an appeal except under very limited circumstances where the court even controls that. So there are no appeals to be had. It means your case is over. And so in this instance, it almost invites the defense to bring the motions back at a time when it, I won't say handicaps the case, it literally stabs it in the heart and kills it.
So Judge Cannon, by my estimate, could be perceived as dumb like a fox, in the sense that, you know, people thought, oh, well, this is, she's ruling against former President Trump, you know, this is great for the prosecution. Wrong.
Absolutely.
Wrong. The way it was done, it could be fatal to the prosecution.
The prosecution should be very, very, very concerned. And again, even more so because it seems as if, based on the dicta or the language or the outcome that the judge has outlined, it seems that the judge is actually inviting this to come back.
Yeah, come on back, folks. Come on back later and we'll revisit.
And part of it may have been, hey, I'm just not really happy that I had to, you know, endure those two rounds of slap downs from the appellate court. No judge really likes to be corrected by the appellate court, but that's what the court is there for. And so having had that experience now twice during the pendency of this case, both in favor of the prosecution, now it seems that either the court, either the judge or those around her have wised up and said, you know what, there are a couple ways to skin this cat. The cat might not like it, but we'll get it done. You don't have to do it right now, judge. You can do it later. And when you do it later, there's nothing that can be done. It is game, set, match.
Well, I want to thank you, Judge, for our conversation today. It was energetic. if I hope it was informative to people out there. We've got so many things coming up that we want to talk about. One of the things I want to talk about, Judge, next time is the whole idea of discovery and how that is plays, but what it means and how it plays between the prosecution and the defense. We got the New York case, the Stormy Daniels hush money case continued because of a discovery issue. And then I also want to talk about bond on after judgment, bond on appeal.
You're reading my mind. That was going to be something I mentioned, was the issue of bond.
I just noticed that former President Trump, his attorney said today, this is Monday, that he could not find a surety bond for $450 million in the New York fraud case. And so he's going to the Court of Appeals to ask that bond be reduced. So we need to talk about the whole idea of somebody getting a judgment and what that means, and how, if somebody appeals, what the whole idea of a surety bond is. And so we've got a lot of things to
absolutely
unpack.
We can also talk about what options exist over and above a bond. There may be options available to secure the value, at least, of that $457 million short of a bond. So we could talk a bit about what those options are.
Not if you don't want to put a huge lien on your
seizure,
real estate.
Yes, property seizure.
All kinds of things to come up. So, Judge, thank you so much for your time today, and we'll be back real soon to follow up.
Looking forward to it. I hope the audience enjoyed this conversation as much as I did.
Today, we've been talking with retired judge and legal analyst Gail Williams-Byers about recent court rulings in the various cases against former President Donald Trump. Spectrum is produced by WOUB Public Media. Adam Rich is our co-producer. I'm your host, Tom Hodson. Please subscribe to Spectrum. You can do that at Apple Podcasts or at NPR One. Spectrum also is available through the NPR Podcast Directory. We always welcome your feedback, so please rate our podcast or review it through one of your favorite podcast outlets. If you have questions or comments about our podcast, or have suggested topics for us to cover in the future, please direct them to me by email. You can do that at hodson@ohio.edu. Have a good day, everyone.